The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Jenny Graves is titled, Hormone Therapy Saved Me from Mood Swings and Hot Flashes. I was in my mid-40s when my body and mind staged a subtle insurrection. At least once a week, I woke up at 2 a.m., sweat streaming off my skin, then lay awake, my thoughts spiraling from one problem to the next. Fat started migrating to my abdomen in spite of my rigorous daily exercise routine and healthy diet. I find myself blanking on words, peony, puree. I suspected that these changes were portents of the change and figured I'd white-knuckle my way through, but I wasn't the only one affected. One night my husband Gordon and I were driving home from dinner when he made a wry comment about our teenage son's forgetfulness, a topic that by turns amused and bemused us. This time, though, I exploded at Gordon, accusing him of being cruel, disloyal, and uncaring. My response was so uncharacteristically savage that he pulled over and said, I'm worried about you. Are you okay? I knew several women whose marriages had imploded while they were going through menopause, and one admitted that her mood swings were a contributing factor. I didn't want to blow up my life. I didn't want to blow up, period. I booked an appointment with a highly regarded women's health specialist. She explained that the fluctuations in my mood and body were likely due to seesawing hormone levels and scrawled two prescriptions for hormone therapy, or HT. One was for a small FDA-approved patch infused with a low dose of estradiol, the same type of estrogen my body was no longer consistently churning out. The other was for a progesterone pill because taking estrogen alone increases the risk of uterine cancer. Before 2002, doctors prescribed hormone therapy to women for everything from hot flashes to heart disease prevention, tempestuous tempers to thinning bones. But that year, a women's health initiative, or WHI, trial with more than 16,000 participants revealed that HT users who were taking estrogen and progestin, a synthetic form of progesterone unlike the micronized progesterone I was taking, which is identical to the kind our bodies make, had a higher risk of breast cancer, heart disease, blood clots, and stroke than those taking placebo pills. The clinical trial ended 3 years early, and millions of freaked-out women tossed their HT pills in the trash. By 2011, when I first applied an estradiol patch to my abdomen, the WHI results had been reevaluated. Women in the trial had been, on average, 63 years old. Newer research showed that for those in their 40s and 50s, I was 48, HT could actually protect the heart. For those in their 40s, it might even protect the brain as well. And for every 10,000 women taking estrogen plus progestin, there were only around 9 extra cases of breast cancer each year. My doctor's advice to use the lowest effective dose for the shortest amount of time echoed that of many women's health experts back then, including the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS. Participants in the WHI study had taken a 0.625 milligram pill of estrogen every day, but by 2011, doctors could prescribe different doses of the hormone in patch form. I started on 0.0375 milligrams, the second lowest dose. A month later, when I still felt edgy, I went up to 0.05 milligrams, which turned out to be just right. HT was so effective, the year or two I intended to stay on it extended to 8. All that time, my mood and weight stayed stable. My night sweats were mild and infrequent. I had no hot flashes or vaginal dryness, and my sex drive stayed as strong as it ever was. The truth is, I continued to feel young. But in 2019, The Lancet published a meta-analysis of 58 studies, which found that among women who started HT at 50 and used it for 5 years, 8.3% would get breast cancer, compared with an estimated 6.3% of women who never used HT, an increase of about one extra breast cancer diagnosis in every 50 HT users. Even in women who stopped HT, the risk remains somewhat elevated for more than 10 years. At this point, I was 56. Worried that it might be time to remove my patch for good, I called Joanne Pinkerton, MD, Executive Director Emeritus of NAMS. I generally recommend tapering off after 5 years or by age 60 because some of the health risks like breast cancer or dementia do inch up with duration or age, Pinkerton told me. Though she added that the experts still don't really know what the true risk of breast cancer is because the Lancet research included a preponderance of women on higher doses and older forms of estrogen and progesterone than are typically used today. You can slowly go off over 3 to 6 months to give your body time to adjust to the withdrawal. So in September, 2 months before my 57th birthday, I cut my patch in half with my doctor's approval. For the first 2 weeks, I felt fine on 0.025 milligrams, the lowest dose doctors typically prescribe. Even when my night sweats returned, I thought, no big deal, I can handle this. Nearly 10 weeks into the reduced dose experiment, though, I was at a holiday party chatting with a friend's spouse when I was suddenly pulsating with heat. Moisture beaded on my upper lip, and I could feel sweat trickling into the waistband of my velvet pants. I blurted, I think I left my phone in the bathroom and fled. In the loo, I saw in the mirror that my silk shirt had sweat stains at the armpits and a blotch on the back as if someone had sloshed a cocktail on me. I texted Gordon, problem, gotta go, meet you out front. I had thought that by the time a woman went off HT or lowered her dose, she'd be through the worst of her menopause-related symptoms. That's often not how it works, says Marjorie Gass, MD, a former principal investigator on the WHI trials and a member of the editorial board of menopause. Many women's bodies respond to the withdrawal of estrogen, whether it happens as they approach menopause or when they go off hormone therapy. So if you were prone to symptoms before, you're likely to have them when you stop using hormones, although they might not be as severe. In a 2013 study, researchers in Italy looked at 196 women who started HT in their late 40s or early 50s and stayed on it for an average of 7 years. In the first 6 to 12 months after they stopped treatment, 93% experienced symptoms such as hot flashes, joint pain, difficulty sleeping, vaginal dryness, and mood problems like depression, irritability, anxiety, and fatigue. 25% were so miserable they resumed HT. In those who stayed off hormones, the incidence and intensity of symptoms diminished gradually. By the time they'd been off HT for 3 years, most had mild issues or none at all. Still, 3 years? I decided to see what happened if I stayed on my minuscule dose. After 2 months and a dozen or so hot flashes, I started to feel able to cope with the sensation of being suddenly filled with molten lava. Dressing in layers helped, as did being blunt. Sorry, hot flash, I'd say, as I threw open windows and shed sweaters. I began to think that maybe quitting altogether wouldn't be so bad. I'd always changed my patch on Sundays and Wednesdays, but one Wednesday in February, I removed my old patch and didn't apply a new one. By Sunday, I was headachy and tired. By Wednesday, I was irritable and weepy. A few more days, and I could feel the rage building. I snapped at Gordon when he put away the milk I'd just pulled from the fridge and got testy with our older son when he called to ask about our health insurance. I found myself ruminating about slights real and imagined, the friend who hadn't answered my text, the late nights Gordon was spending at the office. I already exercised and meditated regularly, two strategies shown to bolster mood during menopause, so I felt stuck. The following week, I reached out to Stephanie Fabian, MD, director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health and medical director of NAMS. There's no reason to torture yourself, she said. Talk to your doctor about going back on the 0.025 dose, or even 0.05, and revisit it next year. You don't suddenly go from low risk to high the moment you turn 60. Lots of my patients over 60 are on HT. I had one in her 80s who came to see me because her doctor refused to refill her prescription. She'd been off HT 6 months and hadn't had a single good night's sleep, and the lack of sleep could potentially do more harm than the HT. I put her back on hormones. She'd already been on the treatment for years without any adverse effects, so it was highly unlikely that continuing would cause problems. The key to using HT safely, Fabian said, is annual checkups during which you discuss the pros and cons of staying on the treatment. If your cholesterol or blood pressure is creeping up, for instance, you might need to consider going off. A non-benign breast lump, time to stop. On the other hand, if you're doing fine and have a family history of osteoporosis and fractures, you might want to stay on HT longer, since bone protection is one undeniable benefit. I felt disappointed as I applied a new halved patch. My inability to get through menopause without chemical assistance felt like a failure. But 2 weeks after I went back on the lowest dose of HT, my mood lifted and I felt more like my old, younger self. When Gordon forgot to pick up wine for a dinner party one evening, I was mildly annoyed but not enraged, and I knew I'd made the right choice. In the complex hormone therapy calculus, my health will always be the most important factor, but my happy marriage is an essential part of the equation, too. Our next article by Wanzani Moot is titled, Nadifa Muhammad's The Fortune Men Recreates the Life of a Man Wrongfully Convicted of Murder. In her third book, The Fortune Men, Nadifa Muhammad recreates the life of Mahmoud Matin, a Somali seaman wrongfully convicted of the 1952 murder of Lily Volpert in Cardiff, Wales. Matin's story became a 17-year preoccupation for Muhammad after reading a news story on the case. Her novel was shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year, and it's not hard to see why. It's a riveting tale in which Muhammad brings to life a 1950s port city and the injustice that occurred there. The book was published in the United States on December 14th by Knopf. Muhammad conducted years of research into Matan's life through archives, newsreels, and transcripts from his court case, as well as conversations with people who knew him. She met relatives of each of the families in the book, among them Matan's granddaughter, a Volpert family member, and the son of one of Matan's friends, Berlin. I wanted to meet as many people connected to the case as possible, and that was a massive benefit to me because all these small stories, the texture of these people's lives, only came alive once I met the living people around them, says Muhammad. Mahmoud Matin was born in what was then British Somaliland in 1923 and landed in Cardiff after years traveling the world with the Merchant Navy. This is a story about Matan's last few months alive, though we are also taken back to his childhood in Africa. The author's father knew Matan. Both were from Hargeisa, joined the Merchant Navy, and moved to Hull, England in 1947. Matan eventually moved to Wales, where he met and married a Welsh woman named Laura Williams, with whom he had three children. They settled in the multicultural village of Tiger Bay, where Matan found community with Somalis and other immigrants. Matan was a petty thief who was well known to the police, and on the fateful night of Storrner Volpert's, renamed Violet Velaki in the novel, murder, they came knocking at his door. Despite a woeful lack of evidence against Matan, inconsistent stories from witnesses, and clues pointing to other suspects, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to hang. He became the last man to be hanged at Cardiff Prison. Even nowadays, in 2021, I would be circumspect about how I talked to the police because of what they could do to me, because of the power that they had. That was not the case with him. From the minute they came to his boarding house on the night of the murder, he told them exactly what he thought of them, that they were liars, that they were just trying to implicate a black man because they are racist, says the author. The book moves back and forth from Matan's life to Violet Velaki's family, showing the impact of her death on the community. Muhammad writes about both sides with empathy. On inhabiting Matan's character, Muhammad says it was a physically and emotionally taxing story to write. It was hard because we know how it ends, so it's no surprise, but as a writer, as I got closer to his character, as I wrote that last scene of him in jail, I was sobbing. You feel the dread he felt, the fear, you feel the anxiety, you feel his entire body saying no, 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 his resistance. Despite the difficulty in writing about a condemned prisoner, Muhammad also found pleasure in imagining Matan as a young man with the whole world in front of him. He was adventurous at a time when there were few like him in the countries he visited and the ships on which he worked. In The Fortune Men, Matan thinks of his death and what will be lost. The only substantial inheritance they will have are his stories, parceled out by Laura or Berlin and covered in their own fingerprints. They will hear that he was a nomad, a chancer, a fighter, a rebel, but not from him, and therefore they will know the price of being all that. The potion and the poison taken together, Muhammad writes. Through nearly 50 years of fighting for her husband's exoneration, even after his execution in 1952, Laura kept his memory alive. In 1998, his conviction was finally overturned. Now, with the success of the Fortune Men, Muhammad is keeping Laura's husband's story alive. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, I Got Distance Reiki from a Practitioner on the Other Side of the Country. It was 3:20 on a Friday afternoon in New Jersey, and I was about to let a stranger in California shift my energy fields. Or at least that's how Francis Nod, founder of Four Noble Holistic Healing, explained long-distance Reiki the night before I underwent my own session. Sitting in our Laguna Beach home, Nod said she would first splay out a few crystals and then run her hands over the formation as if it were a shrunken-down, shinier version of my body. It makes zero sense to our brain, but it's phenomenal how Reiki works so effectively through space and time, Nod told me, to which I nodded along with a degree of skepticism. We'll see. Prior to meeting Nod, I thought Reiki was kind of New Age massage. As I learned, physical touch is rarely involved with Reiki, a type of energy healing developed in Japan in the early 20th century. Reiki is a high vibrational energy force that is transmitted through a practitioner who must be trained and attuned to that energy. When that energy moves from the universe through the practitioner into the recipient, their body is best set up into natural healing, according to Nod. Nod says the goal is to activate a healing process. During a Reiki session, Nod explains, the physical vibration in a person's body heats up or slows down based on how the practitioner shifts energy. In doing so, Reiki supposedly moves the body out of fight or flight and into rest and restore mode, and according to Nod, sets the body up for continued healing on its own. While there is no scientific evidence that Reiki actually leads to healing, Nod's clients use the practice for a host of ailments, physical issues like insomnia, indigestion, and headaches, and mental blockages. If they don't specify anything, I let their body speak and tell me how it wants to be aligned, she says. Typically, Reiki practitioners run their hands between 1 and 3 inches above a client's body and focus on balancing the 7 main chakras, each of which is said to govern different sectors. Our chakras are energy centers. When our chakras are out of alignment, we can feel confused, stagnant, and unmotivated, Nod says. We feel like we can't take the next step. Reiki can help to align those chakras so we're grounded, like I know what the next step is and how to move. According to Nod, it's completely possible to experience Reiki's beneficial effects without being in the same physical space as the practitioner. While Nod always offered distance Reiki, she switched to offering exclusive distant Reiki due to the pandemic. Now she says she may never return to in-person sessions because she claims the results are still effective, if not more so. The person is so relaxed and open to receiving, Nod says. But to believe in long-distance Reiki is to make a logical leap out of the conventional ways of thinking, especially hard for first-timers and skeptics. In a brief aside, Nod broke down the mechanics of long-distance Reiki. The way that we experience space and time is not how space and time exist. We live in a linear timeline. We transcend space and time with Reiki. It's energy, she said. Her go-to metaphor is about love. You can love someone oceans away. You can feel that person's energy even if they're not in front of you. Had I let myself think about Nod's explanation too much, too hard, I would have gotten stuck at a mental blackboard writing out all the facts I knew about space and time. Instead, I took the advice Nod gives doubters. Just try it once. 9 times out of 10, you'll learn something. Ahead of our session, I identified problems I wanted Nod to address, namely anxiety and a lack of motivation exacerbated by a year of quarantine. While I didn't expect the session to banish what seemed to be perpetual problems, I'm also not one to turn down potential options. To prepare for the session, Nod recommended I find a quiet, comfortable place to sink into for half an hour. That Friday, I told my family I would be retreating into the astral realm and would appreciate their lowering the volume for half an hour. I laid back on my bed, my head resting on the pillow. My room was in full spa mode, a diffuser blowing citrus-tinged oils, a silk sleep mask over my eyes. I pressed play on the half-hour song on YouTube Nod had provided, entitled Deep Healing Music for the Body and Soul, and waited for the deep healing to begin. And then for a while, nothing. None of the tingles, twitches, sudden memories, visions, tears, heat, cold spells, or emotional swells that Nod told me to expect. I didn't feel anything other than relaxed, which, given my hectic schedule, was still a welcome feeling. So when something began happening to my right leg, I was surprised. My right leg got suddenly undeniably hot. When the sensation in my leg subsided, I waited for the next flare-up. My stomach was next. It churned, but not in a seasick way, more in a falling in love way. I imagined a soda stream under the lining of my skin, fizzy but pleasant. Certain areas, like my hands and legs, also became comfortably warm. Alongside the sensations rose doubt. Was I feeling this, or was I imagining feeling this? According to Nod, the Reiki detractors attribute the practice's purported benefits to the placebo effect, or imagining something to be true. But in the spirit of growth, I surrendered to the feeling. As I did, memories and dreamlike images rose up, replacing my intrusive thoughts. When the YouTube song ended abruptly with an advertisement for a bank, I sat up and exited the meditative state faster than you can say meditative state. What just happened? Did anything happen? I got my answer half an hour later when I received an email from Nod containing a 40-minute audio recording of the session, accompanied by a photograph of the crystal arrangement and four oracle cards she pulled for me from the Work Your Light oracle deck. Nod spoke throughout the half-hour Reiki session. While listening, I heard what she was doing while I was laying in my bed, wondering if the sensations were real. At the start of the audio recording, Nod, in a soothing voice, identified the specific healing crystals that were calling out to her for my reading, like blue kyanite, which fosters communication, and aventurine, helpful for jumping into the next adventure. I heard the crystals clinking as she arranged them in the loose shape of a body. Then she was ready to begin the session. Moving through space and time, connecting fully, she said, before locking into my energy. Listening to the recording was like seeing through the other side of the mirror and finding there's a world bordering our own. Nod, unlike all Reiki practitioners, incorporates channeling during the session and calls herself a conduit for the spiritual realm. During the recording, she delivered messages and deciphered images supposedly from my spiritual team or the disembodied being supposedly watching over me. And possibly you, for that matter. She says we all have our own crew. Among other tidbits, my spirit guides said I needed to ease back on the sarcasm and inject gentle kindness into my internal dialogue. While that is admittedly general advice, there were some revelations that made me gasp for their specificity. When the Reiki session started, Nod immediately corrected her pronunciation of my often mispronounced name and later said my team guided her. Inexplicably, Nod also named the presence of a specific figure on the other side who I had been thinking of constantly. While providing in-depth interpretations of messages and images from my spirit guides, like a whale's tail, a sphinx, a flying bumblebee, and a rose garden, Nod said she cleared out my seven chakras. She especially focused on resetting my throat chakra, which governs communication. "You're making space to hear your intuition more," she said. Overall, the theme of the recording was calming my inner thrashing, as she called anxiety and insecurity, and preparing me for an upcoming period of transformation. It is, after all, my Saturn return. Nod told me I'd end the session with my chakras open and feeling more balanced. But the real test of distance Reiki, I figured, was what happened after the session. As it turned out, I coasted through that weekend on a wave of positivity and motivation. I completed tasks that I'd avoided for weeks, started a new passion project that stemmed directly from my intuition, and didn't feel the usual Sunday dread. But the real change wasn't what I got done, it was how I felt. I was refreshed, relaxed, and comfortable with the idea of not doing anything at all. Since the change was subtle, though, it took me days to connect my new mood with the Reiki sessions. I can't say definitively whether distance Reiki was responsible for my cheerier-than-usual weekend, but I'm inclined to think it was. After the session, I opened Nod's email seamlessly, taking for granted that it's possible to send a photograph and a recording across the country in an instant. Yet the concept of email is likely one that would have shocked my ancestors. In fact, those stamp-buying, card-sending people may have discounted the internet as a possibility entirely. Is the receiving the energy of long-distance Reiki so far off from receiving an email? Maybe not. Perhaps in a few centuries, we'll know the science behind it. For now, I'll just enjoy the good vibes. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, What It's Like to Get Engaged in an Adele Concert in Front of 10 Million People. I need everyone to be quiet, Adele said, pausing the music during her concert special, Adele One Night Only, which aired on November 14th of 2021 on CBS and also featured an interview with Oprah. The lights at LA's Griffith Observatory, where Adele was premiering songs off her new album, were dimmed. Across the stage, Quentin Brunson, 31, led his blindfolded girlfriend, Ashley Mann, 33, to the center of the outdoor theater. She took off her blindfold to see her boyfriend of 7 years down on one knee before a crowd of hundreds and at-home audience of 10 million. Oh my God, she said, processing, what are you doing? What ensued next was a moment of genuine, unscripted delight, with Brunson keeping Mann's attention with heartfelt bows, despite the distractions of the A-list audience, the confusion, and the serenade from Adele. After Mann tearfully accepted Brunson's proposal, she took a seat between Lizzo and Melissa McCarthy, who passed her a much-needed tissue and a glass of champagne. The producers told me during rehearsals, make sure you have some tissues in your pocket. It went through one ear and out the other, Brunson recalls to Oprah Daily, laughing. Melissa had my back, Mann says. Speaking to Oprah Daily, Mann and Brunson walked us through that surreal evening, which they say they're still processing. Everything was just shock on top of shock on top of shock. First of all, he's down on one knee, shock. My ring is huge, shock. Adele, shock, shock, shock. And then Lizzo and Drake, shock, Mann says, laughing. The high is still going. Mann, 33, knew Brunson, 31, had planned a surprise for her that Sunday. After 8 hours spent rolling sushi at her job as a chef, though, Mann wasn't sure she was up for the adventure. Still, Brunson wouldn't take no for an answer and was adamant she leave work early. He's usually not that dramatic, so I was like, okay, it's clearly something important, Mann says. Maybe she reasoned he was finally taking her to visit a pumpkin patch. She'd been wanting to go for ages, but says her boyfriend doesn't like corny activities. Or maybe he was surprising her with tickets to a Drake concert. Mann's imagination wasn't big enough to imagine what would come next. I like surprises when they end with a big ring on my finger, she says. Brunson, too, was surprised by the shape his proposal ended up taking. His initial plan was to propose marriage to Mann this holiday season while visiting her family in Ohio. Then he saw an advertisement seeking someone who wanted to propose in an amazing way. I was like, you know what? That sounds like me, Brunson says. After days of Zoom interviews meant to gauge Brunson and Mann as a couple and ensure that when he asked the question, she would say yes, Brunson was selected. It probably helped, Brunson says, that when producers asked for Mann's favorite singers, he named Adele. However, the event itself remained shrouded in mystery. I found out it was the Adele special the day before it happened. It was a lot better than I ever could have imagined, he said. The day of the concert, which was moved up a day due to inclement weather, Mann left work and got ready in under an hour, slipping on jeans and pulling her wet hair into a bun. She says if she had known what was coming, her hair and nails would have been done. At 5 in the afternoon, the couple stepped into a black car complete with charcuterie and wine. I was like, this is the best trip ever. We can go around the block and come back and I'm good, Mann recalls. They ended up driving to Griffith Park, where they had an extravagant picnic before getting back in the car. Mann thought that was the date, and then Brunson handed her a blindfold. He said, I was only going to be blindfolded for 5-10 minutes, but it wound up being 20. I was exhausted from work and I dozed off for a second, she says. When the car stopped, Brunson sat Mann on the back of a golf cart, which transferred them to the concert. Then he led her to the center of the stage and told her to remove her blindfold. Though Brunson had prepared in rehearsals earlier that day, he was caught off guard by his emotions. He was shaking the whole time and crying, Mann says. Brunson replies, I'm just glad I was able to get out what I needed to get out, and she heard it, and she was able to experience the moment. In an unaired portion of the concert, Adele brought the couple on stage and chatted with them about their story. Afterward, Brunson and Mann said they were treated like the celebrities in a crowd full of celebrities. As soon as it ended, Tracy Ellis Ross comes running up the aisle and I was like, well, can I hug you, Mann recalls? Then Oprah was right behind her and Drake and Kerry Washington. Brunson says people had one main question for him. Did she say yes? In the whir of the moment, Mann's yes was obscured. She appeared to mouth the word instead of exclaiming it out loudly. I blacked out. I don't really remember it, so I'm like, I think she said yes, Brunson says. Mann confirmed she did say yes. She also appreciated that Brunson had been listening to her not-so-subtle hints about the style of engagement ring she wanted, a solitaire diamond cut. For the 3 weeks between the concert's filming and its November 14th air date, Brunson and Mann had to keep the details of their proposal secret from their friends and family, even the ones desperate to know. "Nothing I tell you is even going to compare to what you're going to see. You won't even believe me," Mann says, repeating what she told her best friend. Now their phone batteries are constantly being drained for messages from loved ones and strangers alike. "This is the most love I've seen on the internet," Brunson says. For those who know the couple, the proposal is the latest in what was already an epic love story. Brunson met Mann while he was staying with his fraternity brother in an LA apartment located near Mann's. They met by chance in the building, and when Mann found out Brunson was moving in, she figured it was a matter of time before they got together. "Every day I tell my roommate, he's going to be my boyfriend. She's like, you're crazy." I'm like, "You wait and see," Mann says, laughing. "We casually dated for 2 years, and then he figured out that I wasn't going anywhere because he was stuck with me." Today, Mann and Brunson consider one another their best friend. They bond over their shared love for adventure and their vegan lifestyle. Mann's Instagram account, @gracefulvegan, features recipes galore. "I'm literally marrying the best person on earth. He's the kindest, sweetest, most thoughtful," Mann says. Brunson says he admires Mann's authenticity. "I've never met anybody like her. No matter who else is around, she's her," he says, adding that audiences resonated with that specifically. She's the superstar. After a bleak year and a half period for many, Brunson and Mann hope their example brightened people's days. "It's important to show love to the world right now, especially black love," Mann says, pointing to the stereotype of black people coming from single-family homes or not getting married. "We are completely in love, and we completely believe in black love, and we know there's more of it. We want to show people we do get married," she says. While the wedding details haven't been finalized, they already know one thing for sure. Adele's rendition of "Make You Feel My Love," which she sang to them at the show, will be their first dance song. "We felt it. That was her intention, to have us feel her love," Brunson says. After all, the surprise proposal was entirely Adele's idea. The proposal illuminated the hope inherent in Adele's decision to think about her own happiness and walk away from her marriage. By doing so, she made room for more love, including her love for herself. "I think she wanted a happy ending, like, this is kind of something that I went through and I'm on to the next thing," Mann says. Our next article by Lisa Arbetter is titled, "How to Find the Right Kind of Therapy for You." Laura, a self-proclaimed feelings nerd, started seeing a therapist proactively before the birth of her daughter as a precaution against postpartum depression. Unfortunately, after only a few sessions, the therapist abruptly left the practice. Before Laura, last name withheld for privacy, could find someone new, her father fell gravely ill with COVID-19. As an only child, Laura had to manage coordinating his care, and his medical decisions fell to her to handle, all while 7 months pregnant and working. And, as is protocol with COVID patients, she couldn't even be at her father's bedside to comfort him as he passed away. "I wanted to lie on the couch, cry, and feel all the feelings," says the 29-year-old. "But between planning the memorial, managing his affairs, and taking care of a newborn, grieving for my dad became something that had to happen in small pockets, like in the 5 minutes I had to shower." Around this time, she stumbled upon Wobot, a chatbot therapy app. Though Laura had been skeptical when she first heard of AI therapy, now, amid a crisis, she was willing to give it a try. She responded to a few prompts, and the app recognized she was grieving. It then asked her to describe her dad and her feelings about his death. "I realized that no one had asked me those questions and how badly I needed to answer them," says Laura. "I was able to put into writing how wonderful my dad was and how much I miss him. It felt like a weight was lifted." Wobot is but one example of how technology is changing the face of mental health care. Psychedelic drug treatments are coming to the fore, and interactive mind-body therapies, such as EMDR, or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and somatic experiencing, or SE, continue to be used. Therapy no longer just means lying on a couch talking about your childhood, and the hope is the field's evolutions will make mental health help available to more people in more areas. It shouldn't come as a surprise. People are stressed out right now. Here in the U.S., before the pandemic, an estimated 11% of adults reported symptoms of anxiety and depression. As of June 2021, that number has climbed to 30%, according to data from the National Center for Health Statistics and the Census Bureau. But it's not just COVID worrying us. This past year has been very stressful for many in terms of a reckoning with racial justice issues and the political turmoil, says Lynn Bufka, Ph.D., the American Psychological Association's, or APA, Senior Director of Practice Transformation and Quality. Layer on top of that the fact that over 100 million Americans live in rural areas, which due to lack of funding or infrastructure, have a shortage of mental health professionals, less than 1 per 30,000 residents, and you have the perfect petri dish for growing a mental health crisis. Technology provides some hope. Teletherapy has been positioned as a democratizing form of care, says Hannah Zeven, Ph.D., author of The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy. It has long promised that it will open up the barriers to seeking mental health care in this country. That theory was tested during lockdown when receiving therapy remotely became the default. The good news is that research suggests that sessions over the phone or via video can be just as effective as psychotherapy done when people are in the same room, says Bufka. The less good news, only 5% of those surveyed for a Time Magazine Harris poll said they'd gotten mental health care for the first time during COVID, meaning the expansion of teletherapy didn't bring in large numbers of new patients. Technology on its own doesn't solve our current mental health crisis, says Zeven. For it to fully reach its potential, it must be supported by infrastructure changes that bring broadband access to remote areas and policy changes that allow therapists to practice across state lines and compel insurers to pay. Plus, each new technology that's introduced brings with it a unique set of issues. With text-based therapy, for example, there are privacy concerns. Where is the text stored? With chatbots, there is unease about the lack of a real human connection. To be fair, Wobot doesn't claim to be a therapist, more a coach or self-care expert. We do know that a lot of users express satisfaction with these technologies, says Bufka, which could mean the distinction between self-care and actual therapy may be less important to them than the convenience and, in the case of Wobot, the free price tag. As for Laura, her daily check-ins have been valuable. For now, it is something I will continue, especially for those everyday ups and downs. I actually feel better after using Wobot, she says, and I think that's an incredible use of technology. Charna Cassell says by age 14, she was in therapy to work through the physical, sexual, and emotional abuse she endured during her childhood. Anything intimate freaked her out. She would panic if someone she liked made eye contact or called her beautiful. I thought that the level of anxiety that I lived with was who I was. It wasn't until I did somatic work that I was like, oh my God, this is just a response to trauma. Charna, now 46, and a marriage and family therapist, psychotherapist, and master somatic coach, found somatic therapy at 24 after a decade in talk therapy. In those early days, she would find herself crying during a boundary-setting exercise that involved her shaking her head yes or no, but didn't understand why. I didn't understand then that trauma was stored in the tissue, and in that moment, I was responding as if I was in that past situation instead of sitting in a room in the present. Somatic therapy focuses on the body as well as the mind. Through grounding exercises to root clients in the present moment, relaxation techniques such as meditation, sensation awareness, and physical exercise such as dance or other movement, it seeks to make clients more conscious of their own physical presence and where in their bodies they experience their feelings. Peter A. Levine, Ph.D., is the author of Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, and the developer of a trauma healing treatment called somatic experiencing, or SE. He noticed that while all animals, including humans, experience automatic fight, flight, or freeze responses to threats, animals in the wild don't suffer the effects of trauma the way humans do. The problems start after a freeze, says his research. Our body still produces the same massive amounts of energy as it does for fight or flight, but while animals will discharge it by shaking and trembling after danger has passed, humans often thwart this process, stopping ourselves from crying or yelling, for example, which can cause us to hold the trauma in our tissue and can leave us in a state of chronic stress. Practitioners of SE believe that to heal, we have to complete this process and release that energy. This is done slowly with the therapist walking the patient through different moments, when they last remember feeling joy or when they realize they had survived a traumatic incident, and asking the person to notice and describe their body sensations and positions. The therapist carefully watches the patient's physical reactions and decides when to plunge further and when to pull back. SE is not a form of exposure therapy. It specifically avoids direct and intense evocation of traumatic memories, Levine and his co-authors write in a paper describing the therapy and the research he used to create it. The thinking here is to avoid reliving the trauma over and over, which could lead to someone plunging deeper into it. Instead, SE practitioners gradually and indirectly approach charged memories and facilitate new sensations around them. SE was developed to treat trauma, but it can work for stress-related illnesses too. And while research is limited, there are papers that strongly suggest it's beneficial. One found that, of the survivors of the 2004 tsunami in Thailand who underwent one or two sessions of an SE-based intervention, 90% reported partial to complete remission of symptoms 1 year later. While not new, EMDR recently made news when Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex, received the treatment on camera in his and Oprah's docuseries, The Me You Can't See. He explained that the trauma from the death of his mother was triggered whenever he was in London and manifested itself in feelings of being trapped. EMDR has allowed him to feel calm while visiting the city. After some initial assessment, EMDR patients are asked to revisit traumatic events while rapidly moving their eyes and perhaps performing repetitive tapping on their shoulders and knees. According to the APA, unlike other treatments that focus on altering the emotions and responses resulting from traumatic experiences, EMDR focuses on the memory, with the intention of changing how it is stored in the brain. The result is a reduction or elimination in the problematic symptoms. Though how it works isn't entirely understood, it's thought that the eye movements or tapping re-stimulate the ability to process distressing events. Still, its effectiveness is clear, with organizations such as the APA recognizing EMDR as an effective form of treatment for trauma. Priscilla started EMDR after a toxic job left her questioning her abilities and feeling physically ill. For months, the 31-year-old says she endured gaslighting and insults from her inexperienced supervisor, who at one point even told her to see a therapist about getting on meds. Priscilla went to Human Resources with documentation of the incidents and asked for a supervisor change. Her request was denied. The situation brought up a feeling from her past of not being believed, so she and her therapist decided to explore that using EMDR. During the first session, Priscilla says she felt the venom dissolve. I pictured a container of water being poured into an ocean, and just that easily, something that had been so heavy my entire life went away. 5 years ago, Leah got the shock of a lifetime. Her good friend was murdered while out for a run. The violent trauma threw the formerly playful writer into a state of hypervigilance, super alert to her surroundings and fearful that people in her life would disappear. Talk therapy, EMDR, and antidepressants all helped. But it was a visualization during a psilocybin magic mushroom ceremony that has had lasting effects. One of my therapists describes trauma as a scratch on a record that will always keep the music from playing until you smooth it out, she says. I had heard a lot about psychedelics as a tool for smoothing some of those deeply rooted trauma grooves. So in 2019, she attended her first ceremony. Lying on a mat in a room with a guide and a few other people, she embarked on her journey. She saw herself with a ball of black matter inside her stomach, which she realized was her trauma. As the visualization continued, she extracted the matter and held it in her hand. I saw that I could hold this experience close, have it in my hand and cradle it, but I don't have to be one with it. She credits this insight with allowing some playfulness back into her life. The new perception allowed a little bit of light to creep in, says the 31-year-old. While several U.S. states and cities have or are in the process of legalizing or decriminalizing psilocybin, it's not legal yet. The relief the drug brought Leah, however, is backed up by extensive and ongoing research. In 2019, the FDA deemed psilocybin therapy a breakthrough therapy. Institutions such as Johns Hopkins have research centers devoted to the study of it and other psychedelics. And this year, one study done by Imperial College London's Center for Psychedelic Research showed that two sessions of psilocybin therapy reduced depression more quickly than a 6-week course of a leading antidepressant. But psilocybin isn't the only Schedule I drug deemed by the DEA to have no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse, showing promise in mental health care. MDMA, aka ecstasy, a synthetic drug that acts as a stimulant and hallucinogen, just took a big step toward approval with the release of MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, Public Benefit Corporation's PBC First Phase 3 trial. It found that 67% of participants who received MDMA in conjunction with psychotherapy no longer met the criteria for PTSD, compared with 32% of those who received therapy alone. What's remarkable about treatments with MDMA and other psychedelics is that they seem to help people work through their trauma instead of just dampening the symptoms. Your body has healing intelligence, explains Amy Emerson, CEO of MAPS PBC. If you have a bad cut, a doctor might put those edges together, but your body does the healing. With MDMA treatment, she says, the therapist and the drug are there to put the edges together, but the brain and the patient do the work. Their use in clinical settings couldn't be further from dancing at a rave. There is conversation or journaling before and after to ensure intentions are set, and once on the drug, patients remain under the watchful eyes of mental health professionals. Study volunteers are also screened to exclude those who may have adverse reactions. Ketamine, another drug with a storied past, is also being used to treat depression, but it differs from psilocybin and MDMA in at least one important way. Ketamine is FDA approved as an aesthetic, making it legal for physicians to prescribe off-label for depression. A 2018 meta-analysis conducted by Carlos Zarate, MD, of the National Institute of Mental Health showed that while antidepressants work 40 to 47% of the time and take weeks or months to take effect, ketamine has a 65 to 70% response rate for treating mood disorders and starts to work within 24 hours. One ketamine convert is Anastasia Burke. "I've always felt less than," says the 62-year-old. "If you look at me on paper, you'd see very positive qualities. I teach Pilates, I train horses, I've sold a book, and I've done all that while legally blind, which tends to inspire people." While she likes the idea that her story is helpful to others, it can also be a burden. What if they find out I'm a fake? On top of her imposter syndrome, Burke has had her fair share of trauma. In 2013, her sister committed suicide, and she suffers from chronic fatigue, a result of the same autoimmune disease that attacked her eyes. Then in December 2020, she stumbled on the Addicted Mind podcast. The episode featured an interview with Dylan Binion, founder and CEO of MindBloom, which offers clinician-prescribed guided ketamine therapy in 11 states. Before it was over, she was on the computer applying to be a patient. After weeks of interviews to make sure she was a proper candidate for treatment, she started therapy. MindBloom does its sessions remotely, so Burke was in her own bed with her husband nearby when she set her intentions to accept change as possible, put on the eye mask, and took the tablets that had been delivered earlier. "After that first session, I had a feeling of incredible well-being and wonder, a feeling of great openness. It was like my body had been all closed down and suddenly it broke open. I felt ready to take in anything good that came my way." At first, Burke needed to receive the treatment every 5 to 8 days to keep her depression at bay, but after 6 months of doing the hour-long treatments, as well as the daily prescribed journaling, she felt strong enough to taper back to going every few weeks. Then this past June, her newfound peace was tested. On her way back to her hometown to celebrate her mom's 80th birthday, she got the news that her mother had died due to pneumonia. A trip meant to be a celebration of life was now something else entirely. And if planning a memorial and sorting through her mom's things wasn't enough, Burke's brother re-entered the hospital for a heart condition the day before the service. "I am absolutely convinced that without ketamine and the tools I have implemented in my life through MindBloom, I would have completely fallen apart, started drinking, letting my emotions take over, and all in all put in a dismal performance when both my mom and my brother needed me to step it up," she says. "I've made more progress in 6 months of working with MindBloom than I made in 40 years of other therapy." Fewer than half the 20.6% of U.S. adults who experienced any mental illness in 2019 received care, which proves there is work to be done to ensure everyone gets the help they need. With researchers, practitioners, technologists, and academics expanding what it means to get help and developing different modalities to do so, the hope is that more people will find something that fits for them. Is it illegal to take psychedelics for therapeutic purposes? It depends on which psychedelic you're talking about. Ketamine, a powerful psychedelic, can be legally prescribed to treat certain mental health conditions, but that's the only one that can be prescribed on the up and up. However, that may change soon. I've seen a shift in the medical, social, and political perspectives on psychedelics, says Ronan Levy, co-founder and executive chairman of Field Trip Health, whose mission is to heal people through psychedelic therapy. Institutions such as New York University, Johns Hopkins, and Yale are actively researching psychedelic treatments and their effectiveness. How to find the right therapist for you. The right practitioner can make or break your experience. Lynn Saladino, PsyD, a therapist in New York City, shares tips on how to identify the right person. Treat it like a job interview. If you were hiring for a job, you wouldn't hire someone based on their resume alone. The same applies to a therapist. Before signing on with someone, ask for a 10 to 15 minute phone call to discuss your needs and get a feel for the therapist's demeanor. Ask about their treatment approach, familiarity working with clients like yourself, and educational background. Consider convenience. When it comes to finances and scheduling, being realistic about your needs will set you up for success. While you likely won't need to be in therapy forever, unless you want to, it still takes time. Before selecting someone, really consider whether or not you can afford their fee for an extended period of time. When it comes to schedule, think about whether a therapist who can only see people during working hours will fit into your day. If not, focus your research on someone with early morning or late evening appointments. If it doesn't feel right, move on. After a consultation, you might not know if a therapist is a good fit until you sit down with them. Just like dating, you can have a great first date, but after a few more meetings, it may become apparent that it's not the right fit. Follow your gut and don't feel pressure to extend the treatment longer in hopes that it will improve. Yes, therapy can be uncomfortable, but feeling a mistrust or discomfort within the therapy dynamic rarely leads to successful work. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is Why Did I Dream That I'm Pregnant? A dream analyst offers the real reason. I dreamed that I was 7 months pregnant, as in actually pregnant. It didn't feel like pregnant with a new idea or project. I felt great, superhuman even, but I was huge. Then I started feeling jittery, like I'm not ready for this. I was telling God, I'm not ready, take it away. A voice said, are you sure? Then something calmed me from within. I woke up feeling loved and protected, ready to take on anything. Signed, not pregnant. Dear not pregnant, your dream strikes me with its powerful symbols and characters. The symbol of pregnancy is so personal and so universal at the same time, and the character is God. This dream speaks to me of a powerful moment in your life and of your realization of your own power at this moment. You describe yourself as actually pregnant in the dream. For you, this is no metaphor. Rather, you're describing your powerful interior core, which is huge, even superhuman. Are you facing a decision in your waking life in which you need to realize your inner power? It could also be the decision itself you are carrying, or perhaps a waking situation that comes with a huge responsibility. Moreover, you're entering the third trimester in your dream. Are you close to a deadline, perhaps one that you suddenly find overwhelming? When I was 7 months pregnant, nothing fit me. You could say I had a new identity. Further, I realized I was now sharing my life with another person. 7 months into a pregnancy is the moment when reality sets in and when you might start feeling scared. Could there be upcoming wedding bells for you? If it was my dream, a marriage might link me to a new identity. Dreams about a spiritual or higher power point us back to our deepest selves. As I explained in a recent column analyzing a dream about an animal guide, our spirit dreams lead us to the roots of our inner strength and intuition. When we find ourselves at a crossroads of some kind, we often reach deep inside in order to motivate ourselves onward. That's because in this moment of truth, self-doubt appears. When we experience self-doubt, we may look inside for the answer. We might also call out for help. In your dream, you do both. You were reaching into this essence of yourself as represented by God in your dream and describing yourself as not ready. You asked this higher being to take it away. Are you asking to have your power taken away? Or perhaps you're at a crossroad and this is what you want removed from your life. When your higher self poses the question, "Are you sure?" the solution lies in your response. Something calmed me from within. It's as though the help you called out for arrived in a different form. Instead of removing the situation, you remind yourself of all the good you have inside, even in the face of your self-doubt. This core confidence that you're acknowledging brings you the sense of inner peace and love you need in order to move forward. The caring side of you knows that you're okay and you can do this. Ask yourself, what part of me is the source that sends this message of calm? Going back to the story and images you chose in this dream, does it possibly speak to your inner child? Or might it speak to that part of you that's an expert in loving and protecting others? Those are characteristics often associated with maternal love. Perhaps you need to start exercising those skills on yourself. Each of us has a different association for our most essential self. We might associate our core with a spirit animal or with an angel or deity as in your dream. The point is, when we're at the moment of truth, dreams about our spiritual foundation can help us find our path ahead and tell us how to take care of ourselves as we follow it. Wondering what that crazy dream you had could possibly mean? Don't let it keep you up at night. Our in-house dream analyst, Lean Dalfin, author of the Have a Great Dream books, is here to help you make sense of it all. In a twice-monthly column for Oprah Daily, Lane draws upon her decades of experience to explore what a reader's dream is trying to tell them. Thank you for spending time with me today, and I look forward to reading more from OprahMag.com for you next week. Have a great day. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.